In the new book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom, award-winning author Rebecca Grant charts the reproductive freedom movement from the days before Roe through the seismic impact of Dobbs. The stories in Access span four continents, tracing strategies across generations and borders. Grant centers those activists who have been engaged in direct action to help people get the abortions they need. Rebecca Grant is a freelance journalist based in Portland, Oregon, who covers reproductive rights, health, and justice. Her work has appeared on NPR and in New York Magazine, The Atlantic, The Nation, The Washington Post, and Mother Jones. She is the author of the book Birth. The new book is Access, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Grant to the roundtable this morning. Rebecca, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
It's very nice to have you, and we thank you very much for being with us. At what point did you decide to take on this project and look at it in such a comprehensive way?
I started thinking about the proposal and the scope and kind of the specific subject matter in 2022, I would say, in the lead up to the Dobbs decision. I was doing a lot of reporting at the time, both about what was happening kind of, you know, nationwide with the politics and the courts, but also I started to build relationships with some sources who were preparing for the potential overturning of Roe by figuring out what alternative models of access would look like. And so talking, you know, they were talking with international activists about how they sourced medication, for instance, that they could distribute outside of kind of FDA approved channels. And so I really got interested in what the resistance would look like if Roe was overturned, or what the models of access would look like and how they would evolve and change. And then that led to, as I said, international activists who had really supported a lot of the Americans as they were figuring out what this new post-Dobbs landscape would look like. And then I really kind of knew some of the history from the days before Roe, from just reporting that I had done or research I had done over my 10 years on this beat. And I started to notice these really interesting connections between what activists in the 60s and early 70s were doing and the activists today, even though a lot of the specifics, you know, today we have medication, we have the internet, like things look different. But in some ways, there were these really striking similarities that I wanted to document.
Pre-Dobbs, as you were looking at this and people were, as you say, preparing for the decision, how much did they get right as to what that landscape would look like and what we're dealing with now?
I think they got a lot right. And I think there were two main areas that I was looking at, or kind of threads that I was looking at. One is the work of abortion funds. And, you know, their work is totally legal, totally above board. Abortion funds, kind of as like a national network, have been around since the 90s. But what a lot of folks in the abortion fund movement or the reproductive justice movement have said for years, long before, you know, Dobbs was even like a whisper, was that access was already so limited across the country, right? There were so many laws that had chipped away at access, that had provided all these additional hoops that patients had to jump through, that had closed down clinics. So there are these vast swaths of the country already where people couldn't access abortion care. And, you know, things like the Hyde Amendment restricted federal funding for abortion. So that made it difficult to access for lower income women. And so I think for abortion funds, a thing that they've said is that the work that they were doing, it did change, of course, in the wake of Dobbs, but they were already existing in a world where there were a lot of people who couldn't access abortion in the place that they lived. And so, you know, they were sort of already doing the thing that they were going to continue doing. And in the wake of Dobbs, they have really scaled up dramatically. I mean, twice as many people are now traveling out of state for abortion care as were before Dobbs. And the amount of support that they're distributing is to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. So, you know, I think in that way, they're already doing the thing. And then on the other kind of thread that I follow, which is these modern day underground groups, as I said before, like the international activists that they were building relationships with, those folks have been operating in banned contexts and criminalized contexts for decades. And so they already kind of knew this is generally what you have to do to maintain the accessibility of abortion when the laws are restrictive. And so I think that that support from the international activists meant that the Americans could get up and running so much faster than they would have been able to otherwise. And a lot of these international folks were offering their expertise, their infrastructure, their advice, their support. They're sort of models that people can adapt. And so I think that the kind of seeds were all there. And it was really a matter of scale after Dobbs.
Did the international access change as a result of what happened in the United States, in the sense of, were they learning lessons as well?
That's an interesting question. I think that something a lot of activists have said to me, international activists, is that they all pay really close attention to what's happening in the US. And so whereas what's happening with abortion rights in Poland might not be a major news story in the US, although, I mean, I have reported on that, so of course there's some coverage, but I think what was going on in the US, which was a huge news story for them. And there's a striking kind of example of in September of 2021, when SB 8, which was that quote unquote aid and abet law in Texas passed, which was sort of for a lot of folks in the movement considered to be this death knell for the future of Roe. That was the same day that the Mexican Supreme Court made a decision decriminalizing abortion. And so I don't know that, you know, I think the international groups, international anti-abortion forces, are absolutely emboldened by what happened in the US. And there is sort of this idea that like this backsliding is possible. Like in Argentina, for instance, that the decriminalized abortion, there's now these efforts to roll back the laws. And so I think it's something that's really hard to track in a direct like cause and effect kind of way. But all of that is just to say that international activist groups who are both fighting to expand access and who are fighting to restrict it are paying close attention to what's happening here.
One of the aspects of the book that is fascinating is the women that we meet that are on the front lines, that are working on this, and that you have just described in many ways of what they're doing. Tell us about the Jane Collective.
The Janes were a group of activists, a group of women in Chicago in the late 1960s, who many of them had come out of the civil rights movement or were actively involved in the civil rights movement. And as part of kind of the wave of, you know, second wave feminism back then, folks were getting together, they were doing consciousness raising groups, they were sharing their experiences. And so there are a lot of things going on, but one of the things that some of these women started to talk about was the harms of unsafe abortion. I mean, there were so many unsafe abortions and the complication rates were so high back then that hospitals had dedicated wards called infected OB. And so this was something that a lot of these women either knew someone who had had an abortion or they had needed one themselves for whatever reason. And as they were talking about it, they, you know, believed that it was an important life-saving really issue to make abortion care more accessible. And so it really starts with this one activist named Heather Booth, and she got a call from someone who asked if she knew where they could go find a safe abortion provider. And then one call led to another, and word got out, and some of the, you know, these feminist groups started getting more organized. And so they ultimately built this collective where at first they were making referrals to safe and kind of vetted abortion providers that had been shared with them by word of mouth. And then they had kind of like their own, I guess you could say, in-house provider almost that they worked with that they could send folks to. And then at some point, once they realized that the provider they were working with wasn't actually a doctor, he was a layperson who had received training, they had this idea of like, wait, maybe we could learn how to do this ourselves. And so a small kind of inner core group of the Janes taught themselves how to provide abortion care, how to do the procedures, which back then it wasn't medication. I mean, they were using surgical instruments and tools, and they set up multiple houses and locations where they could refer patients to and provide them with really what was remarkably safe and effective care. And by the time they were caught, by the time that the arrest happened, they had provided facilitated abortions to 11 to 12,000 women in the Chicago area. And so they were a powerful example, along with some of the other activist groups that I document in that portion of the book, of really women who had seen the harms of unsafe abortion, who understood the risks, and kind of took the matter into their own hands to figure out how to make an illegal abortion as safe as possible.
The name of the new book is Access: Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year battle for reproductive freedom. In that chapter, and you're writing about Chicago in 1968, but you have a sentence here that I want to read. With abortion legal in New York, the Jane started sending callers there, but some reported back that the experiences weren't great, that they'd received rude and insensitive treatment. It was a lesson that lawful did not automatically translate to good care, and that illegal care didn't have to be inferior. I found that fascinating to understand that even if it was legal, it was not necessarily the best care that a woman could get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that a lot of, you know, because these were feminist groups and these were women who were providing the care, I think they had a different sense, a different orientation to the issue and to the people that they were treating than some of the professionals who were coming from a more kind of institutional or established background who saw their work as really kind of exclusively providing medical care as opposed to all of the other things that abortion care can entail and sort of, you know, it's not only healthcare, right? There's like all of this other stuff that goes into it. And I think that that sentence could almost equally apply to kind of the underground versus the legal options that are available today, because for a lot of people, even if they have access or they could access a legal abortion, they could go to a brick and mortar clinic in the place that they live. They're choosing in some cases to self-manage their abortion or to use telemedicine because they find working with some of the activist networks or they find being able to stay off the radar to manage their abortion with medication in the privacy of their own home with, you know, all the discretion, the convenience that involves to be an option that is better, a better fit for them or preferable than going to a clinic where everything is kind of, you know, as it has been for a long time. And so I think that there's, you know, I think that line and that lesson really still has resonance today as it did back then.
Once Roe passed, did the situations get better and what happened to these organizations?
Yes, I think the situations did get better because once, you know, back then, someone's ability to access a safe abortion was hugely contingent on, I mean, their resources certainly being the number one thing, but also right. Like, did they know someone who knew about these activist groups? If they weren't able to get to Chicago or they didn't know about these groups in California that were also providing referrals, for instance, I mean, they were still having to resort to these potentially unsafe and dangerous methods. And so, you know, after Roe happened, clinics started to open across the country. And that was just, I mean, of course, absolutely a game changer. And I think that certainly there was still folks who after Roe were practicing kind of abortion outside of institutional settings, who were engaged in alternative models. But I think for the vast majority of people, for the most part, everything was really centered around this clinic-based model. And that involved having to physically go to a clinic, of course. And I think that something fascinating that's been happening, really, I think, precipitated by COVID, because for a long time, one of the two medications of the medication abortion protocol couldn't be mailed due to FDA regulations. And so you had to go to a physical clinic, but during COVID that changed. The FDA amended its policy and so mifepristone could be mailed. And now we have all of these telemedicine opportunities that, you know, channels that people can go to access right. The medication at home. And that is part of why abortions have actually gone up since Dobbs. And so I think that one of the things that's interesting that's happening now is there's a little bit of this sort of blurring of lines. There's more of a gray area now. And it's not as clear cut, like what is illegal and what is not illegal. And everything is so different from state to state. And so I think that there's just been a lot of evolution over the years as the technology has changed and as folks in the movement have kind of adapted to take advantage of that technology.
And we can only assume that technology will continue to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know from my reporting with some of these community support networks, they're constantly evolving and trying to make what they do better. And, you know, the telemedicine model like that has also evolved, and Shield Law providers, which are folk, you know, legal doctors, clinicians who are live in states that have laws that are called Shield Laws on the books. And then they are prescribing medication to people in all 50 states. And that's like a super innovative kind of model of abortion provision that we hadn't seen before. And so I think as the situation continues to change with the laws or with the technology, you know, people are reacting to that and getting really creative. And I think, you know, especially with two of the main characters in the book, Dr. Rebecca Gompertz and Veronica Cruz, they, part of what I think distinguished them and made them these leading international abortion rights activists was their creativity and their resourcefulness and their ability to see things and kind of make these innovative ways to make sure that abortion was accessible with the tools that they had available to them.
And they were good. I mean, you read about this, but they were good about finding those tools, right? I mean, those mm-hmm. tools of finding what they are and realizing that they could be tools available to them.
Absolutely. So in the case of Dr. Gompertz, around 2000, she started an organization called Women on Waves, which sailed boats to countries with abortion bans and then transported women into international waters where national laws didn't apply, but the laws of the Netherlands where the boat was flagged to. And then they provided medication abortion at sea. And so that was a case where she was not only using the technology of medication abortion, although she had been prepared to provide, you know, actual procedures if she needed to, but also like loopholes in maritime law. I mean, just what incredible creativity. And she had had the idea because she had been a physician and a worker on a Greenpeace boat. And so she was really inspired by the work that Greenpeace was doing with their Rainbow Warrior and their boat campaigns and saw this opportunity to apply it to abortion care. And then in the case of Vero, she, you know, the other drug in the medication abortion regimen, misoprostol, that was available over the counter in pharmacies in Mexico because it was an ulcer medication. And so she, along with many other Latin American activists, realized that if they could sort of let women know about this via word of mouth, they could go to the pharmacies and buy the misoprostol, which can be used on its own, and then share that information. And so again, like the resources on hand, figuring out ways to get creative and sharing that information with as many women as possible.
This idea, and you touched on it, but Rebecca Gompertz, that you read about in the book, a Dutch physician, Women on Waves, and this operating these boats, you have a chapter in the book about their arrival in Ireland and in Dublin, Ireland at the time, and those who are waiting for them on the coast as they arrive. And that's just a fascinating because people were finding out, right? It was becoming understood of what the work that was being done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the boat campaigns, their intent was to provide abortions to people who needed it. It wasn't some like kind of publicity scheme. They weren't just doing it to drum up attention. Like their intent was to provide abortions. And Dr. Gompertz and her team had done so much legal research and so much logistical work. I mean, they had a mobile clinic and a shipping container on board the ship that was fully equipped to provide procedural abortions. They had like an OBGYN on board and a nurse. So that was their intention. And at the same time, a huge part of her mission, as with the Greenpeace missions, was to raise awareness, was to emphasize and illuminate the injustice of abortion bans and to let people know that abortion medication was available. I mean, that was especially true a little bit later, as word of that started to arrive, but also just to start a dialogue because, you know, in some countries, activists had been continuing to fight for expanded laws, but sometimes there was something about having this big kind of dramatic thing that everyone was talking about, right? Like abortion was on the front page of all of the newspapers, and this campaign was something that people were now engaging with the issue in a way that didn't enable it to just kind of be in the background or, you know, one issue among many. And she really used that, you know, to her advantage. So in Portugal, the boat that they sailed, Women on Waves sailed, wasn't actually able to reach shore because Portugal deployed naval warships to prevent them from accessing the national waters. And so they weren't able to dock, they weren't able to carry women out to sea to provide them with the medication. But instead, the fact that these naval warships were blocking the boat and the boat that these activists were on was tiny and these warships were huge, that became this huge story. And then Dr. Gompertz went on to a local TV program and she explained what the protocol was on the air. And I don't think anyone had ever done that. I mean, certainly not in Portugal, but maybe not on TV ever. And again, she was sharing that you could access the medication, the misoprostol, in pharmacies there. And so even when they were prevented from their kind of explicit mission, which was to provide abortion care, they really used that, like I said, to their advantage to stimulate a conversation. And in many of these cases, you know, the timelines vary, but those countries went on to reform their abortion laws and make it legal.
One of the things about Gompertz of going on and working, and you have a chapter about the work being done in the Republic of Ireland, especially around 2018, but they were taking their work, and while it was being questioned of whether it was legal or it wasn't legal, they were publishing in top medical journals, and I mean, that's a very open way, right, of going and saying this is the work that we're doing, even though in places that we're doing it, it is illegal.
Yeah, and there was a couple, there are a couple of examples of that. So Dr. Gompertz felt it was very important from the beginning to be as rigorous and kind of legitimate, I guess you could say, as possible. And yeah. So with all of her campaigns, even though they sound really bold and radical, which they were, but she was adhering to the law. I mean, she found these loopholes that she really cleverly exploited. And I think that she wanted to make it clear that what she was doing wasn't this radical thing, it wasn't this dangerous thing, that she was providing medical care. And as part of that, she was pushing kind of medical knowledge forward. And I think as an academic herself, she studies a lot, and she, you know, has multiple degrees. And so it was really important for her to emphasize that what she was doing wasn't some radical thing. And so I think that was really true with Women on the Web, where no one had really done global telemedicine abortion care before, or probably telemedicine abortion care period. And so they collected all of this data so that people, you know, because then if someone said like, oh, surely it's not safe to send someone medication abortion to take by themselves at home, and then Dr. Gompertz and her research colleagues and her organization could say, oh, well, no, here's the study that we did that shows that it is safe. And so those studies both inspired other activist groups like the Zocaristas in Argentina. They collected a ton of demographic information and published reports on their website about the people that they served. And then when the debate was happening about changing their abortion laws, the work of Dr. Gompertz and her research colleagues was cited as part of the debate, because it was showing that like so many women in the Republic are accessing abortion care via telemedicine, and it's very safe and effective. And, you know, also I think that information was really important when we were changing our laws around mailing, or our policies around mailing the medication here in the US. And so the research was really an important part of the broader mission, the broader effort, which is to, you know, have abortion laws change globally.
Rebecca Grant is the author of the new book, Access: Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. You write in the book about how COVID has such an impact on the work of so many of these women who were in the front lines and were working so hard as the laws were changing in this country. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they ultimately came out of that?
For a long time, there had been some resistance, I think, or reluctance on behalf of mainstream medicine in the US, and even folks who are really active supporters of abortion rights, of abortion access, around telemedicine abortion or mailing the medication. And so, you know, the FDA had put mifepristone under really, really strict regulations. It was very tightly controlled, and that was a limit, that was a barrier to access. But I think that it was something that, you know, public health researchers, and so I talk about two who went on to co-found the organization Plan C, but they were in Ethiopia in 2014 or 2015, and they had a colleague walk into a pharmacy in Ethiopia and buy a safe medication. It was called the safety kit, a medication abortion kit that they just purchased in a pharmacy for like $5. And so for these researchers, they were so struck by that, because in the US, you might have to go to a brick and mortar clinic with all of the obstacles that that can entail and pay $500 to $600 to get the same medication. And so they were just really struck by like islands of Ethiopia, how easy it was to access the medication versus the US. And so starting around 2016, they were doing research about how accessible medication abortion was outside of clinics. And they were trying to start a conversation with other kind of activist groups or other advocates or public health researchers about why it was important to liberate medication abortion from all of the regulatory constraints it was under. But that was a conversation that they got a lot of pushback for, and they had a really hard time breaking through in any kind of like meaningful mainstream way. And then COVID happened. And all of a sudden, the notion that it was riskier for someone to receive a prescription at home and manage the process there, the notion that that was more dangerous than it was to schlep all the way to a clinic with like a pandemic raging where you have to go to a gas station or maybe a bathroom or a hotel or a restaurant, and then you have to go to a clinic and there's all these people in the waiting room and there's the staff. I mean, you know, the idea that that was going to be safer, all of the potential exposures to COVID that that would entail than something at home, it just really changed the risk calculus. And all of a sudden, the idea of mailing the medication was truly a lifeline, and it felt sort of bananas not to do that. And so once that happened, the way that one source put it to me is that the genie was out of the bottle. Once telemedicine abortion was something that was accessible, patients clearly were responding to it. They were clearly really happy for that option. And certainly not every patient, like that is not a viable option for every single person. There are still plenty of people who need to and want to make it to a brick and mortar clinic. And they of course deserve that option. But yeah, the genie was out of the bottle. There was no going back from there. And I think the fact that, you know, today, I believe it's 1 in 5 is the most recent number that I saw. 1 in 5 abortions happens via telemedicine in the U.S. And that's an enormous shift in a very short period of time.
In the afterword of the book, you say this is a supremely strange, volatile, and uncertain moment. 1 week into President Trump's second term, he issued an executive order reinstating the global gag rule, pardoned 23 anti-abortion activists who were convicted of blockading abortion clinic entrances in violation of the FACE Act, and overturned 2 of President Biden's executive orders that shored up federal abortion protections in response to Dobbs. Leading to your point that you make that there is really no end to reporting on this issue.
Yeah, I've been on the beat for 10 years. I know my first abortion article that I did was in 2015. And it has actually, it's kind of cool because there are elements from that first story that I ever wrote on the beat that are still present in the book today. And I think that I have never been wanting for topics to cover on the beat. And like, I talk about this a little bit in the foreword, but I remember when I was just starting out as a full-time freelancer and I wanted this to be my beat. And I got some pushback or some skepticism from people who were like, this is a settled issue. What is there to report on? People don't want to read about this. Like, it just doesn't seem like there's enough there. And obviously that's not true, of course. But I think that that just continues to be true. There's always new things to look into. There's so much that's constantly going on. And that's really has been true regardless of who the president is. And so, you know, as long as I still continue to find stories that I think are interesting and important that have to relate to this beat, I'm going to keep on reporting them.
Rebecca Grant is the author of Birth. The new book is Access: Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. It is published by Avid Reader Press. Rebecca, a delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Absolutely.
Be well. Again, the name of the book, Access, by Rebecca Grant. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.